David Botsford, Austin, Texas, for Etheridge Hill. As the court is well aware, this case really boils down to whether the Court of Criminal Appeals' habeas decision in 2007 was objectively unreasonable. It's our position that if you look at the facts of this case, this is not an Oregon versus Elstad case. It is a Siebert case. And the state court habeas decision.
Now, why do you say it's a Siebert case?
Your Honor, it's a deliberate two-step situation.
Then why do you say it's deliberate? What evidence do you have that it was deliberate?
Well, Your Honor, we have
deliberate
certain
strategy.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Beg your pardon? Deliberate strategy.
This was a deliberate strategy. The entire orchestration by Detective Gilchrist in going to Maryland, setting this up, misleading the defendant to believe that he wasn't going to be there. Some Maryland police officers were going to talk with him. The facts are very elaborately.
No, but deliberate strategy has to do with the incomplete warning, right? Not their motive in terms of, police officers do this all the time. They interrogate people and they, stay within the limits and imply stuff and whatever. And I mean, this is part of a, but the deliberate strategy has to be a deliberateness in giving the incomplete Miranda warning, right?
Well,
not that they were deliberate in wanting to get a confession from him. I mean, that's what they do all the time. There's nothing wrong with that.
I understand, Your Honor, but this was a deliberate effort to avoid giving him adversarial warnings. The entire inference, if you look at the video.
Why are you saying that as a matter of law, that we should say that this was deliberate when my recollection is that the police officer's explanation was that he didn't have his Miranda card with him, and he read them out, and he read a bunch of them. He just missed this one. And why was it deliberate to just miss that one?
Okay, Your Honor, there are 3 to 4 officers watching this. There's an FBI agent with Detective Gilchrist. When Gilchrist reads or orally gives Etheridge Hill some of the Miranda warnings 45 minutes into the interrogation, okay, it is beyond belief that, and of course, Drury is watching the videotape from the other room. Reed is also there, so there's actually 4 officers, but certainly 3 of them. The Miranda adversarial warning is not given. The entire effort by Gilchrist was to avoid putting Etheridge Hill on the defensive. He didn't want him to think he was in an adversarial position. And the omission of the adversarial consequences warning is the penultimate issue in a Miranda warning. You have to tell him the consequences.
I understand that.
Okay.
But the question here is, would the Court of Criminal Appeals necessarily, were they compelled here to say that this was deliberate or not? I make arguments to this court, I remember, and I planned my strategy and I had them on a little yellow pad and I was going to argue this and this and this and that. And, I went back and I went to the hotel room and I said, oh my gosh, number 2 was what I wanted. And I never even brought it up. That I didn't bring it up was I would deliberately not bring that up?
Your Honor, I appreciate the court's statement. However, if you look at the facts of this case, and of course the state has conceded, not only in its brief on direct appeal to the Supreme Court where cert was denied, but also in the current brief, that the 5 factors identified in Siebert, weigh against the state in this case and constitute objective evidence of deliberate conduct. That's a concession by the Attorney General in their brief. So we have that. More importantly, if you look at the testimony, of course, we have a videotaped interrogation, so there's no question of what happened and when it happened. And we have the consistent failure to give Miranda warnings other than the original deficient oral Miranda warning 45 minutes into it. We see, for instance, even when he's arrested at 8:30, this interrogation starts at after 5 o'clock, and it goes for 5 hours, which is why this is not an Elstad case. This is a Siebert case. But We've got the fact that, you know, 7:30, Roach, the FBI agent, who was present when the original warnings were given, he says, remember, Gilchrist told you about the right to remain silent. Doesn't tell him about the adversarial warnings. Then at 8:30, when he's formally arrested on the credit card abuse warrant, which they had before they got him in there, and which they were not going to tell him about until he either failed to talk to them or tried to leave, at that time, they don't give him Miranda warnings. Then there's another 2 hours of interrogation, okay, where they go back over and they talk. Gilchrist gets out his computer, pulls up the Texas form for a statement. He's got the Miranda warnings all there, okay? He doesn't give the Miranda warnings at that time either. They type out the statement. He prints out a draft of it, comes it back.
What did he fail? He failed to advise them that it could be used against him. Is that correct?
That's the yes, Your Honor. The adversarial consequences warning, which is so important, particularly under Sievert, because, you know, when you've had a two-step interrogation.
He advised him that he had a right to an attorney. He advised him that the court would appoint an attorney for him. And
he could remain silent.
And that he had the right to remain silent.
Right. But not that anything he said could be used against him in a court of law. That's an absolute prerequisite before interrogational, in-custody interrogation can proceed under Miranda. And under Siebert, when you've had a two-step interrogation, and then, you know, when he prints out that printed warning at about 10:15, 10:30, I forget the exact time, he says, you know, these are the same warnings I gave you earlier. That's a misstatement. And Gilchrist deviates again from his normal policy. He testifies at the suppression hearing, I generally have the suspect initial the warnings at the top of the page. In this case, Gilchrist just said, these are the same I had before. That was a misstatement. He had not given the adversarial warnings. He didn't read them out to Hill and say, initially, do you understand these? Do you waive them? In fact, there's no actual request by Gilchrist, do you understand these warnings and do you waive them? Absolutely not. This is a five-hour interrogation where consistently through it, they're using interrogation techniques.
Mr. Botcher, would you help me with a procedure in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
My recollection is that he brought this up on his original appeal, and the Court of Criminal Appeals rejected it, but it sent it back for some other reason, right?
Well, now, Your Honor, they raised the voluntariness of the confession in Elstad.
That's right.
In the original appeal.
That's right. And I guess that's what I'm trying to say is there was a complaint made when he had his direct appeal about the voluntariness of his confession, and then later on gets sent back, and then the Supreme Court decides the case. Was there contention in when it was brought to the Court of Criminal Appeals and the appeal was rejected on voluntariness? Was there a contention made before the Court of Criminal Appeals that the failure to give this particular warning was deliberate? In other words, or was it, it's involuntary?
Your Honor.
Did the Court of Criminal Appeals even have before it, because, you know, the law had not come out when they ruled on it, but has there been a complaint that this was a deliberate act on the part of this police officer?
And yes and no. Let me answer it concisely from the standpoint. At the time of the pretrial hearing in 2000, Siebert had not been decided. Okay.
Right.
In the direct appeal to the Court of Appeals, which goes up and then back, and then it goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals on PDR, it was during the pendency of PDR that Siebert was decided. And counsel for Hill does bring Siebert to the attention of the Court of Criminal Appeals before PDR is denied.
I know. So, okay, but so he brings the case up.
Yes, sir.
My question was a contention made that the police officer's failure to give the adversarial warning of Miranda, that he deliberately did it?
No, I do not believe the record would reflect that. That was even discussed at the pretrial hearing back in 2000, May of 2000. It was based on the law at the time.
Siebert was cited when it came up.
Yes, Your Honor.
But there was no contention before the Court of Criminal Appeals that the act was deliberate.
No, there was.
So there was no contention before the Court of Criminal Appeals that this act was deliberate. Why should they think that Siebert would control it?
Well, Your Honor, that original PDR is not the decision we're reviewing. After the direct appeal was over,
right,
after cert was denied, there was a state habeas filed.
Right.
In the state habeas,
you claimed that it was deliberate.
Yes, Your Honor. We cited to the Court of Criminal Appeals the Jones case, which came out in 2003 from the Court of Criminal Appeals, which in fact cites.
No, you cited the case, but did you make the contention,
yes,
that it was deliberate?
In the state habeas, yes, Your Honor. In the state habeas and in the federal habeas. No question about it. And the state court on the state habeas, which was determined in 2007, April of 2007, they had extensive briefing from me on Siebert, why Siebert applied.
Now, did they revisit it, or did they say we've already ruled on this?
No. As you know, Your Honor, the habeas is originally filed in the district court.
Yeah.
That was fully briefed. The state's position was Siebert doesn't apply. This is an Elstad case. Our position was this is Siebert. Elstad does not control. The trial court entered findings of fact, did not address any of the Siebert factors, did not make any findings of fact on deliberateness or not, simply found that it was voluntary. It then goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the only court that can grant that 1107. And in April of 07, despite the briefing and the controversy, the Court of Criminal Appeals denies the writ, the 1107, on the basis of the trial court's findings. Now, our findings, Your Honor, the findings that the trial court came up with are strictly and solely limited to voluntariness.
I know, but once the state trial court on habeas is aware of your Siebert and Jones claim, and he says it's voluntary, wouldn't that implicitly reject the idea? I mean, the fact that it's voluntary is the ultimate conclusion, right? That
it's
not coerced.
It's
voluntary.
Right.
Wouldn't that implicitly, wouldn't that be implicitly saying you're wrong about this deliberateness?
Yeah, and I don't believe so, because the trial court signed off on the state. The state prosecutor submitted proposed findings of fact to the habeas judge. They were originally signed off by the habeas judge and sent to the Court of Criminal Appeals without any hearing, without anything from us. It was remanded by the Court of Criminal Appeals because that had been done ex parte. When it gets back before the district court allows me to file some additional pleadings, proposed findings of fact, both sides. He signs off again verbatim on the state's proposed findings of fact, which are just limited to the voluntariness and saying that this is an Elstad case, basically reaffirming what the Court of Appeals, not the Court of Criminal Appeals, had said on the direct appeal. And so the Court of Criminal Appeals definitely had the opportunity to say, because we presented it, that this is a Siebert case, not an Elstad case. And the key thing with Elstad, that's a three-question inadvertent obtaining of statements from a defendant before Miranda is given, not a five-hour interrogation when at the end you don't even have a waiver of Miranda warnings specifically read. Gilchrist deviates from his normal procedure. And I've got to say this. The state's theory, this was an honest mistake by three law enforcement officers on the admission of the adversarial consequences warning, that is not plausible. They say that Gilchrist said it was a mistake, but if you look at the testimony at page 164 and 165 of the pretrial hearing of May 14, 2000, you will see that all he was saying is, I didn't have a blue card. But he was in Maryland for 2 days. His normal procedure is to have that blue card, read the rights at the time he gives Miranda warnings, and have the defendant sign off on a waiver on the back. He had his computer. There's three officers minimum watching. He could have opened his computer at that time. He could have gotten a blue card from the FBI agent. These officers had more than 50 years of experience, more than 100 hours worth of training in interrogation techniques. To suggest that this was an innocent mistake over the period of all the times they didn't read Miranda warnings is just beyond...
Boston, I believe you have a red light.
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Time for rebuttal. Mr. DeAndre?
May it please the Court. Federal habeas guards only against extreme malfunctions in state criminal justice systems. To ensure that habeas release is rarely granted, AEDPA bars defendants from relitigating claims here in federal court unless one of three exceptions apply, and the Supreme Court has said that those exceptions are difficult to meet. For two reasons, Hill has not carried that difficult burden. First, he's failed to explain why Siebert even binds the state courts. And second, even if Siebert applies, Hill has not shown the state court unreasonably determined that the police deliberately used a question-first tactic. The first reason the court should affirm is that the fractured decision in Siebert failed to announce any clear legal standard for the state courts to apply. That failure has divided the circuit courts. The Seventh Circuit doesn't believe that Justice Kennedy's plurality applies. This circuit split is strong evidence that the law is anything but clearly established in this area, and it should not, therefore, bind the state courts. In the absence of clarity, this court cannot cast aside a state criminal conviction. AEDPA asks this court to stand in the shoes of the CCA or the state courts and decide that there is no possibility that fair-minded jurists could disagree on whether Siebert is amenable to the Marks rule. Justice Kennedy's plurality this court in Courtney has held that Justice Kennedy plurality applies, but other courts have disagreed with that, and eight justices of the Supreme Court took issue with the deliberateness prong. I'll turn to that now, deliberateness. Even if Justice Kennedy's opinion Siebert is clearly established law, Hill cannot show that the state court unreasonably applied it. I'll point to four pieces of evidence that this was not deliberate. And the right inquiry under AEDPA, as you know, isn't to look at this case de novo. It is to stand in the shoes of the CCA, look at these four pieces of evidence that I'm about to list, and decide whether any fair-minded jurist faced with this evidence could decide that it was not deliberately used. First, the 11th and 3rd circuits have already suggested that partial warnings, as opposed to no warnings at all, create a strong presumption that a deliberate question-first tactic was not used. It makes no sense to give a partial warning if you're going to deploy a question-first tactic, because you alert the suspect in custody to most of his rights, and it also triggers the psychological reaction that the question-first tactic was supposed to undermine, and that is, they start here, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one may be appointed for you. Those phrases will psychologically trigger the instinct, I am in custody, I'm about to be questioned. Second, nothing in the record suggests that the Austin Police Department had ever used the question-first tactic. If the court's opinion in Siebert makes clear that police departments were adopting this as a matter of practice and were doing so openly, nothing suggests APD has done it. I've read published opinions, and none of them suggest or show that APD has gotten in trouble for this kind of thing. Third, Detective Gilchrist had no motive to lie about whether this was deliberate or not. Remember, the pretrial suppression hearing happened 3 years before Siebert was even decided. And so when he said, I left my blue card as an explanation, now granted, he was not pressed on did you do this on purpose or not, because at that point, the issue of deliberateness existed only in the heart of Justice Kennedy, and the LSTAD was the controlling opinion. But there, Detective Gilchrist had no reason to lie, because other police departments were admitting that they were using this tactic and thought it fine, and you might suggest that he would have done the same. And finally, he was with an FBI agent. I think that this cuts both ways. Sure, they both had a lot of experience, but there's also no suggestion that the Federal Bureau of Investigation had adopted this tactic. And in fact, they came out against Siebert as trickery, came out against the question first tactic as trickery before Siebert was decided. I think those four pieces of evidence alone, if you put yourself in the shoes of the CCA, make it clear that that is enough to support their judgment. there are further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. DeAndrum. Mr. Botsford, do you need it?
The partial omission of the adversarial consequence warning was perfectly consistent with Gilchrist's approach to Hill. Do not put him on the defensive. I'm here to help you. I'm here to get the truth. It was a non-adversarial interrogation for part of it, but as Gilchrist himself admitted, this was heavy-duty interrogation. Professor Leo, who deals with coerced confessions, testified at the second day of the pretrial hearing and described all of the interrogation techniques that Gilchrist and Roach had used. But there was no questioning, and I'm not even sure that anybody at this time in Texas was aware of Siebert in 2000 and what had happened in Missouri in the state courts. You know, three-quarter criminal...
How was it clearly established?
I'm sorry, Your Honor? But the date of clearly establishment, Your Honor, is when, as of 2007, when the Court of Criminal Appeals denies habeas. Siebert was decided in 2004. We've got... the last state court decision on the merits was the CCA denial of habeas relief in April of 2007. So it's clearly established as of that time. This court had already said Marx applies. We use Justice Kennedy's. And what's more important and what shows the objective unreasonableness of the CCA's decision is their decision in Jones in 2003, which was binding on them. Jones does not cites the Missouri Supreme Court decision in Siebert and notes the cert grant as of 2003, okay? But what they say there is you can't apply LSTAT and that inadvertent failure to give Miranda to a situation of facts almost identical to ours where there was an hour and a half interrogation. If you look at the facts of Jones in 2003, the CCA busted that, saying LSTAT does not apply. If you look at the facts of our case versus the facts of Elstead and Jones, our facts are almost identical to Jones. And then in Martinez in 2008, of course, they again say, here's a two-step consistent with Siebert. There's no testimony, no questioning about whether it was deliberate or not, because that case, too, Martinez, was decided in the trial court before Siebert came out. There was no reason to go into the subjective intent of an officer in his interrogation prior to Siebert because under Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, the subjective intent of the officers is never relevant until Siebert. And finally, Carter in 2010, another CCA opinion, they adopt Marx. So between Jones, which is decided before our last state habeas, and then Martinez and Carter, it's very clear that the Court of Criminal Appeals, had they followed Jones, should have reversed the district court's denial of habeas. It's our position that it is objectively unreasonable because of that. And if you look at the facts of Elstad, you've got a 10-second inadvertent encounter at the time in his own home, with his mother present, one officer talking to him briefly, one officer talking to his mother. Then they go to the police station. He's given full Miranda warnings. And the Supreme Court said that inadvertent 10-second questioning in the home does not mean that the subsequent Miranda warnings don't cure that inadvertent Miranda violation. This is much different. Never did he get the adversarial warnings at all until after 5 hours of interrogation. Then on a piece of paper where the officer doesn't read them to him, says they're the same warnings I gave you earlier. He doesn't have them, he'll initial those warnings and waive those warnings. So Hill just signs off on it. Why? Because as Justice Kennedy says, unless you tell a defendant in that position that the previous oral statements are not going to be used against him and can't be used against him, he doesn't understand. And that's why Siebert is so important. Siebert's not a new rule. It is merely a modification of the requirement that Miranda warnings be thorough and careful. And that's what Elstead says. You've got to give thorough and careful Miranda warnings to the defendant when there's been a prior violation to Miranda. And to say that merely because they're at the top of that page, and you can look at the video, it's not even clear he read them. You know, Gilchrist says you start at the top of the page and read, and my time is out, but I think the court understands where I'm going. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Botstein.